Welcome to Radio Times, the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Glad you could join us. Ahead this hour, two stories from New Jersey. Governor Murphy's proposed an ambitious new budget, which depends in part on money from a new millionaire's tax and from legal recreational marijuana. Will his fellow Democrats in the legislature give him what he's looking for? Also, New Jersey's Back Bay communities could be socked with billions of dollars in flood damages in coming decades if climate change is not addressed. We'll have a look at a new report from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. But we begin with vacant lots. Philadelphia is a city of immense beauty and seemingly intractable blight. There are thousands of vacant publicly owned lots in Philly which are up for sale. But apparently the process to buy is molasses slow and highly inefficient. The vast majority of buyers find themselves stymied by the city's poorly managed system set up to sell public land. Joining us now with more is Plan Philly's data reporter Ryan Briggs. Great to have you with us, Ryan.
Thanks for having me, Mary.
So if a person wants to buy or express interest in a vacant lot in Philadelphia, there are a number of ways they can ostensibly go about it. Tell us first, Ryan, about the city-run property app, which also happens to be saddled with a sizable backlog. How's it work? Or how is it supposed to work?
I mean, I think the way that we tried to compare it, something we tried to compare it to is like Trulia or Zillow. You know, the websites people might use if they were just looking to buy any piece of real estate. If you go onto the Philadelphia Land Bank website, you'll see some familiar sites like a map of properties across the city that are owned by public agencies. And you can click on the different properties, and there are, you know, buttons that at one point said, you know, click here to purchase a property, or at least to submit an application to begin the process of purchasing a property. But what we found is that in many cases, those applications were never going anywhere. And right now, the city is sitting on something like 20,000 applications from different people that were interested in buying public land who essentially never heard anything back.
And as you report, one flaw, the system doesn't distinguish between lots that have been earmarked for other things, Ryan. In other words, they can't be sold. Do we know why they make it onto the site?
I mean, I honestly, my understanding is that when they set up this website and this system, they never added in that functionality. So, I mean, you know, there's sort of a combination of things that are going on here. And one part of it is that I think there's just a level of sort of a lack of ability to create the kind of website that the city really wanted to create. And then I think the other part of it is that there is just plain old political interference going on that prevents people from really bidding on property that is actually saleable. So sometimes people will select a property that has been earmarked for, you know, redevelopment, like you're saying, and then that application never goes anywhere. And sometimes people will select a property that maybe a council member, you know, had in mind for another kind of use, and that never goes anywhere. But either way, the end result is that buyers go onto this website, they fill out these applications for land that they want to buy, and they never hear anything back from the city.
Before we get on to political influence, worth noting, Ryan, that after you started reporting on this app, the wording was changed. It used to read real estate for sale, but now, what does it read? Buyers need to indicate what their interest, which is a big difference in semantics.
It says something like, you know, click here to say that you're interested in a property. And now when you get an automated response from the city that also says something to the effect of, you know, don't call us, we'll call you if and when we're ever ready to sell this property. But what we saw is that, you know, the vast majority of these applications sit open for, you know, 1 to 2 years. There are some that, you know, have been open for 6 or 7 years. So in some cases, you know, they're just never responding to people. And that's even to say, you know, hey, we're not going to sell you the property. You know, thanks, but no thanks. So it's just sort of a general failure to communicate with people who, you know, want, on a fundamental level, I think, want to give the city money for these vacant, unused properties that it's accumulated over the years.
There are over 4,800 vacant lots in Philly, and in the last fiscal year, you report that only 78 properties were sold. 78. There is a very real consequence for city taxpayers. Can you get into that for us?
Well, yeah. I mean, every vacant lot that the city holds, and they, you know, they get these because they are essentially abandoned by their owners, or maybe there was a severe tax delinquency. There's a variety of reasons that the city has ended up with thousands of these different properties. Every one that the city controls is a piece of land that is not generating tax revenue for the city anymore. So that is, you know, property taxes that go to pay for schools and other public services. And when you multiply that, you know, over the 5,000 or so, you know, lots that the city has that are sitting unused, you know, it adds up to millions of dollars every year, at least, in sort of foregone revenue. And that's not even counting the maintenance costs that the city realizes because it has to pay to, you know, mow and otherwise maintain, you know, these vacant lots. If somebody dumps trash on the lots, the city has to send crews out, at least in theory, to clean up that mess. So there are, you know, there's a tangible cost associated with holding on to this much land.
So Tom Earle, an affordable housing developer, decided to skip the app altogether and go straight to council, city council. Ryan, is this where the real power lies?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we found in the process of reporting this is that when you talk to people who have actually been able to purchase these lots, what they'll tell you is that the website is just sort of, you know, it's a facade on the real process of accessing public land in Philadelphia, which is going through a district council member's office, getting a letter of support from the councilman, getting the councilman or his staff to help move the process along. You know, in the instance of the affordable housing developer, you know, his description is that, you know, there's just this huge gap between what is presented to people on the city's website and the real process. And in his case, he was able to successfully get to purchase two lots from the city. But as you said, he just went straight to the council member and said, here's what we want to do. And we want to build affordable housing, and we want to build it on this, on these publicly owned lots. Help us navigate that process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if he had gone through, you know, the website and done it, you know, the transparent way, the sort of above board way that the city has presented to people, he probably would still be waiting to just get, you know, to, for that sale to go through.
And Ryan, as you write, sometimes politicians use the system to help people they know. A couple of council members in the news recently.
Yeah, I mean, we saw in some recent instances, there was a childhood friend of Councilman Kenyatta Johnson who was able to purchase land at what I think most observers thought was a below market price, and then resell those lots to realize some kind of a profit. There was an instance in Councilman Daryl Clark's district where you saw similar instances of people essentially gaming the system in order to get city-owned land at a artificially low price, or just to get city-owned land at a low price and then flip it to developers who were willing to pay the actual market value for these lots. And that has kind of put all of this, it's put this whole process kind of into the spotlight again. I mean, these are complicated systems. They're sort of obscure parts of City Hall. But this has been kind of a big issue because there have been more clear-cut cases in the news recently of what certainly looks on the outside to be like a process of using political influence, you know, to advantage certain people in this, you know, the city system for selling public lots.
Are we seeing less of this now, Ryan, since the publicity?
What I think you've seen since this happened is that there have been some overtures towards reforming the city's sale process. And so last week, you know, we wrote a little bit about how one of the offices that was handling some of these duties is going away. It's going to be merged into the land bank, which is, you know, a system that was set up by the city to try to make the whole process a little bit more transparent and above board. There are, at least in theory, some other reforms that are in the works in city council right now. And so people are talking about it like they want to reform the system. But, you know, that's kind of where this whole website and where a lot of these processes we're talking about now came from, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. So it's not the first time that we've tried to kind of clean up the land sale system in Philadelphia. So I think it's unclear, you know, what's going to actually come out of all of this.
Well, if you had to characterize the political will, is this a kind of an urgent effort, or is it a wait and see and it could drag on for years type of effort? What's your perspective, Ryan?
I mean, I think that because most people don't really understand how these processes work, because they are confusing, because they are housed in these kind of offices within agencies, you know, it's a very opaque system. And I think that, honestly, that benefits people that want to use political influence to manipulate the process, because it's kind of hard for the average person to understand how all of this works and plays out. I think what you saw in the past is, you know, were good faith efforts to try to reform these systems that eventually, you know, didn't amount to that much because the public kind of lost interest and, you know, or didn't really understand all of the details of what you needed to do to create an actually transparent system. And so again, I'm not sure if you're going to come out of this with the perfectly clean and transparent system that people want, but, you know, they're at least talking about this like a system that needs some serious fixing. I think you saw that with the scandals, you know, recently in certain council districts. I think you see that with the fact that the city's website, you know, for selling land is just hopelessly broken. And so there's at least interest. Again.
And as we're waiting to see how the interest develops, there are thousands of lots which are sitting vacant, which could be potentially redeveloped, some of which are causing blight, and taxpayers are picking up the tab.
Yeah, and I think there is, you know, a case to be made that the city might not want to just sell off all of that land, that you might want to redevelop some of it as affordable housing or for, you know, open space. But as we tried to show in our recent reporting, what's happening right now is that you're not really seeing, you know, either process play out. You're not seeing the auction of public land in order to generate money for the city, and you're not really seeing, you know, strategic, you know, redevelopment or reuse of all of these lots.
All right, Ryan Briggs, sorry, I got to stop you there. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us. Data reporter for Plan Philly. Governor Murphy in New Jersey, his budget proposal is up next. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. New Jersey Governor Murphy's second budget proposal of just over $38.5 billion is an ambitious undertaking. The governor wants to increase funding for public schools, pre-K, higher education, and New Jersey Transit, and put billions into the shaky public pension system. And he wants to do so by again proposing an increase in the income tax for people who earn over $1 million a year, while at the same time implementing some major reductions in spending, including an overhaul of health care benefits for state employees. And he's expecting some money from the anticipated legalization of recreational marijuana. Will he get what he wants? Here now with a close look is Ryan Hutchins, Politico's New Jersey Bureau Chief. Welcome back, Ryan.
Thanks for having me on again.
So let me get the numbers out first. 888-477-9499 is the number to call if a listener would like to join the conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And we begin with a clip from Murphy's address in which he pushes the millionaire's tax.
If we enact another budget like the one our administration inherited, our middle class will continue to be the ones shouldering the burden while seeing very little in return. Yes, A millionaire's tax is the right thing to do, and now is the right time to do it.
So, Ryan Hutchins, this is the second go-round for this proposed tax, which would increase the tax from, I guess, a hair under 9% to 10.75%. Is this the right time to do it? Is there interest among his fellow Democrats in the legislature?
I think for the governor, this is something that's kind of existential. I mean, he might disagree. I think he'd like to have this $450 million in revenue. But it's something he campaigned on. He's talked about, wealth disparity. He's talked about his buzzwords are tax fairness, that this would create some tax fairness for the middle class. And his words, those who aspire to get into the middle class. Now, the problem right now is that the state assembly, which, like the state senate, is controlled by Democrats, they're all up for re-election this year. Mm. So there are a few competitive districts where Republicans hope to make inroads running on, you guess it, taxes. Phil Murphy's taxing people, and this incumbent Democrat is doing his bidding. So I think you're going to see some Democrats fight this pretty aggressively, including the leadership in both houses, Senate President Steve Sweeney and Assembly Speaker Craig Coughlin, both of whom said they opposed the millionaire's tax.
And again, that's a sizable chunk of this budget proposal, $450 million.
It is, but also keep in mind that the governor is touting fiscal responsibility here. He's now increased the surplus this year. They're projecting more than $1 billion. And setting aside close to $1.2 billion to end next fiscal year. So this is quite the increase from a few years ago under former Republican Governor Chris Christie, when the surplus was under $500 million.
He also wants to cut spending, as we mentioned. I think the figure, Ryan, is nearly $900 million would come from reductions in benefits for state employees. So we're talking about nearly $1 billion. Where would this come from?
So it's about $1.1 billion total, and some $200 million of it is coming from departmental savings, attrition, shrinking the state's workforce. It's something that the administration is actually touting, surprisingly, something you could hear Chris Christie bragging about. So various things like that. No layoffs or anything like that. And then, like you said, $800-900 million, and mostly health care savings. Some of it through negotiated contracts with state labor unions. About $200-something million is still being finalized. The governor just before this budget address cut a deal with the largest labor union, the Communication Workers of America, which represents more than 30,000 state workers. And they're going to get 2% pay bumps the next 3 years, but they're also going to pay higher costs for out-of-network health insurance, the idea being that people are going out-of-network unnecessarily. And then there's some broader changes that had previously been agreed to through this process that was set up earlier this decade under Christie, where the labor unions can negotiate broad changes to their health insurance plans with the administration. And it's rather complicated, but involves switching from Medicare to a Medicare Advantage plan managed by Aetna, a private insurance carrier, some things like that.
So back to the CWA contract for just a moment, the Communications Workers of America. Were you surprised that happened that quickly?
I'm not. I'm surprised that they were okay with 2% raises for 3 years. But they have other increases they benefited from. And the governor had eliminated something called step increases. The last governor, Governor Christie, had eliminated something called step increases. And last year, Murphy agreed to reinstate those. So they got some of them got a pretty big, retroactive paycheck last year. And they see benefit to working with the governor, especially if they get him to a second term. He might be free to cut an even better deal with them if he gets a second term. He is a staunch ally of organized labor. And even in his speech, you know, railed against those who demonize public workers.
Well, you know, and Steve Sweeney, the Senate president, comes from organized labor. He wants benefits reform as well. Is he on the same page as Governor Murphy or close to it?
He is not. I mean, he is talking about something much broader. And so the thing to remember with Steve Sweeney, he's been around for about a decade leading the Senate. Some people joke privately that he's the governor of New Jersey right now. And he envisions something along the lines of what he did with Christie early in the governor Christie's first term, which is a restructuring of health and pension benefits that was just the public workers really, really hated. Yeah. They protested in Trenton. They protested Christie. They protested Sweeney. They called him Sweeney the Weenie. They blew up Big Rat in Trenton.
And I remember that.
If something like, you know, what Sweeney envisions now were to happen, we could imagine a repeat of that. But Governor Murphy doesn't seem inclined. Sweeney would like to roll back the level of health benefits provided to some public workers from what he says is Obamacare platinum to gold, and you could save a bunch of money there. He also envisioned something, a hybrid pension system where some New Yorkers would have like part pension, part 401k style savings account. And, you know, that could be something that gets discussed, but the savings there are long term. And that's where he says it matters, because the state's structural deficit keeps growing. Yeah. It's billions and billions of dollars, and the state's trying to climb out, but a severe economic downturn could make that difficult to achieve.
Yeah, well, there's also a lot of reliance on tax collections next month. What are you hearing about what revenue projections are like, or are they out yet?
So the fiscal year starts in July. So for the first 6 months of the year, they're down quite a bit, way behind the projections for the full year. Led a lot of people to worry that there's going to be a huge hole in the budget. But the administration insists that's not the case. They say it's the result of a change in taxpayer behavior ahead of the federal tax code changes and act signed by President Trump, that people in December 2017 paid taxes ahead of time, thus inflating those numbers. So in December 2018, people weren't paying as much in taxes. And they expect those taxes to start rolling in April.
So a rosy projection.
Yeah, and they think they're going to have plenty of money around. The corporate business tax is actually up, and that's saving them. They increased the corporate business tax last year as part of a budget deal too. That it came super close to shutting down state government. The fight over the millionaire's tax last year. And Murphy ultimately settled for a hike on people making more than $5 million a year, and a four-year hike on corporations. They'll phase out in that time period.
So Ryan Hutchins of Political, let's get to recreational marijuana. This budget proposal of Governor Murphy's is counting on, I guess, about, what is it, $60 million from the sale of legalized pot? And, of course, legalization hasn't happened yet. Is it a slam dunk from your perspective? I mean, it seems as if Murphy has gotten some support now from legislative leaders. But is it something that's inevitable in the near future?
I don't know if it's inevitable. They're super close to having a bill ready, a bill that the governor, the Senate president, and the Assembly Speaker and the leadership in both houses agree on. But even among that leadership, there are people who just simply don't know if they're going to support it. It's a very personal issue. You know, no one is going to be, you know, truly strong-armed into doing it if they're against it. So it's going to be a difficult sell. And now that this bill is almost ready, they're going to have an interesting few weeks here where the Senate president, the Assembly Speaker, and the governor are all going to be trying to whip votes to get across the 50% threshold in each house to pass it. Sweeney has said that he thinks it needs to get done by the end of this month because he fears that the wheeling and dealing that will go on if it becomes part of the budget negotiations in the spring.
He was not in favor initially. What changed his mind?
Well, he's been in favor for a while, Sweeney. And he's actually been one of the leading people pushing it. I'd have to go back a ways to remember why he, you know, came around to supporting this. I mean, but the governor also, he came around during the early stages of his campaign and said, you know, he was torn about it as well, that, you know, he has kids and for him, it was a social justice issue. He feels that there are so many people locked up in prisons who don't belong there because of marijuana, that they just simply have to legalize it and start, you know, expunging some criminal records.
Let's look at public schools, Ryan. Aid under a relatively new school funding law would go up. About how much under Governor Murphy's budget proposal?
So the increase in funding for pre-K to 12 would be $282 million. Now, this is part of a formula that was developed last year, a deal with Senate President Steve Sweeney. This was his top issue with school funding, that there were districts receiving far less than they should and districts receiving far more than they should. So they redistributed the amount of money and agreed to step up the amount of money every year that the state is contributing to school districts. So there are some this year that are going to see a decline in state aid as they shift they apply this formula and try to, you know, even out some districts that are, you know, in the middle that have not gotten enough aid over the years.
Yeah, and the districts which aren't, which might be losing, are not taking this quietly, Ryan Hudgens. Apparently there was a protest outside the State House before the budget address, comprised of teachers and parents and students. But on to community colleges, you know, as we wrap up this segment, the governor would like to see them tuition free. And we see some funding in this budget, an increase in funding in this budget that would help him to get closer to that ideal in his mind.
Right. $33.5 million for Community College Opportunity Grant Program. And there's some other changes. Overall, higher education, the budget nets about a $31 million increase in funding. So it's not a ton, but it's, you know, the governor thinks it's a step in the right direction, a step toward that. It certainly seems like it's going to take a long time to get to this ideal of free community college. It's certainly going to cost a few hundred million dollars a year for the state, if not more. So, you know, I think he's got a bit of a ramp up to get there, and he's going to have to keep increasing this funding every year. And I mean, that's one of the fundamental challenges this governor's going to have if he can, you know, making it through this first term and then potentially having a second, is he's got some of this funding that he secured last year. This new revenue is going to start to fade away. Half of about $1.6 billion in new revenue that he won last year is going to be gone within 3 years from this July. Mm-hmm. And the costs are going to keep increasing. So if he wants to keep making these sort of investments in NJ Transit, which is only getting another $25 million in net state aid.
Yeah, which had a rough year last year. NJ Transit had
a
terrible
year.
Yeah. I only have a couple more minutes. I did want to get to the public employee pension system, which is, you know, has been a mess for a number of administrations now. I think this plan calls for a payment of not quite $3.8 billion into the system. But still, Ryan, this is not enough. Actuaries say this is just about 70% of what's needed in order to prevent liabilities from exploding.
That's right. And right now, the state is on a 10-step plan to get to full funding of what actuaries say is needed to keep the system up and running. And it's a big deal because there's no bankruptcy release valve here. The state has a constitutional obligation to pay out it's everyone's pensions. So if the fund runs out of money, then the state is just going to have to take money out of its operating budget to pay people their retirements. So it's really a critical issue for the state. And every year, you know, this is going to keep going up if they don't, you know, until they reach that full funding, and then it can start to go down as the fund reaches the healthy level it should be at now and should have been at for the last two decades. So, I mean, that's going to be perhaps the biggest challenge facing government, and it's one thing that Steve Sweeney is intensely focused on. You know, one thing that both the governor and the Senate president are exploring is the idea of capturing the value of state assets. They did this with the state lottery system. They assigned the value of the state lottery to the pension system and reduced the unfunded liability. More a paperwork accounting maneuver than an actual thing, but it will help the state save money, and I think they could do something like that with other assets, perhaps even the turnpike.
We only have about 15 seconds here, but I'm interested in the concept of a budget surplus. How is that money set aside? What is it set aside for?
So, you know, it's just simply you put a budget together and you save $1 billion, you know, that isn't assigned to be spent on anything. And that's, you know, your healthy rainy day fund in case there's a downturn, in case your revenues don't come in as well. And the governor's hoping that assures Wall Street ratings agencies, and that after 11 credit downgrades under last governor, that this governor can see an increase.
All right. Ryan Hutchins, New Jersey Bureau Chief for Politico, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And this note, WHYY will stream our call-in show, Ask Governor Murphy, Wednesday evening at 7 at WHYY.org. Your chance to talk to the governor directly. Submit questions in advance to AskGovMurphy.org. Stay with us as Radio Times continues. You are listening to WHYY in Philadelphia. This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has identified climate change as a significant contributor to flooding along the Back Bay areas of New Jersey's coastline. And in a new report, the Army Corps says if climate change goes unchecked, coastal communities could suffer billions of dollars in damages in future decades if preventive measures aren't taken. Joining us now in studio with us on this, Peter Blum, Chief of Planning at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the Philadelphia District. Welcome, Peter.
Good morning. Thank you.
And David Rosenblatt is Assistant Commissioner of Engineering and Construction for the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. Hi, David.
Good morning, Mary.
So before we get to the report, when we say Back Bay areas, what exactly are we talking about? We're not talking about necessarily where all the tourists are going, you know, at the start of summer, but some very beautiful areas that, which, you know, are home to a lot of communities.
Right. Well, there are 86 communities in the Back Bay study area, and the area is formed by the 12 inlets that go to the ocean. And, you know, if left unchecked, it's kind of like all of the dune work and all of the sandy beaches that we replenished still don't protect that Back Bay area. So we found out, you know, that a lot of different things from this report. So even without climate change, like just Sandy alone had $30 billion worth of damage in New Jersey.
So let's focus on climate change for just a moment. How is it expected to affect water levels along the Jersey coast, say, over the next few decades, if nothing changes?
So there's no doubt that sea level rise has happened in the past, and it will continue to happen in the future. What's debatable is the rate at which sea level will rise over the coming years, up to the year 2100. I think we can see... expect a moderate level of sea level rise to the year 2050, which is a planning target for us. But when you get to 2100, there are predictions that vary by 2, 3, 4 feet by various agencies like NOAA and the Army Corps, different universities. So you'll see from 2050 to 2100 some exponential sea level rise predictions, which are a little bit scary for us. But we're really focused right now on 2050.
And David Rosenblatt, at the same time, New Jersey naturally is dealing with land that is sinking.
Yes, there is subsidence in various parts of the state, and that's just compounds the problem.
So, Peter Blum, if nothing is done to mitigate climate change, what sort of damages are we talking about, say, by 2050?
Well, we're looking at every year on an average about $1.6 billion in average annual damages, which was incredible.
And
so,
and Atlantic City and Ocean City might take some of the biggest hits, so their Back Bay areas?
Yes, yes, through the Epsican Inlet.
And when we're talking about damage, you know, visually, what am I seeing if I'm looking at damage? Obviously, there's flooding, but what else? David?
So depending on the size of the bay area we're talking about, you could have significant wave damage during a storm to homes. Some homes will be knocked off their foundations. Certainly, there'll be flooding of the homes. And all the other damage that you see after a storm when people cart out the furniture to the curb, all of that is damage.
But the encouraging news for communities in this report is that the threat of damage can be mitigated if preventive actions are taken. The report offers, as I understand it, initial findings on some possible plans to manage tidal flooding and storm surge. So let's take a look at some of those ideas. Storm surge barriers. Peter Blum, what are they? How would they work?
Well, they are a series of gates that would go across the tidal inlets, and they would allow for the normal navigation, normal flows to pass through. However, during big storms, they would be closed to shut off the tidal surges from the ocean.
So who would close the gates? Who would say, all right, it is time to close the gates? Who gets that? Or has that been figured out yet?
Well, we haven't figured that out. But, of course, this would be, we would prepare O&M instructions and that would be part of the study in the design phase.
Mm-hmm. And what are tidal gates or tide gates? Same thing, similar?
They're very similar to a surge gate, yeah. Mary, as a non-federal sponsor in this effort, the state of New Jersey contributes half the cost of the feasibility study. When we got the report, and we have this ongoing discussions with the Corps throughout this process, but when we got the report, one of the first things I look at, aside from reading the entire 262 pages of this, is the operation and maintenance costs, together with the initial construction costs. And if you look at the those parts of this feasibility study that provide a lot of protection for a lot of people, a lot of structures, you also see that there's high construction costs and high operation and maintenance.
So what are we talking about, David? Ballpark with costs?
Billions.
Billions.
Billions to tens of billions.
And who would be footing the bill?
Federal and state taxpayers.
The initial construction is 65% federal and 35% non-federal.
Okay. Well, let's just get to some more of the ideas that could potentially mitigate some of this damage. We're also looking at flood walls and levees. So what do they look like? What do they do?
Well, yeah, thanks. It's much more complicated than the ocean side. So we have to, use the storm surge barriers and the levees. Are flood walls that would kind of just block the flooding from harming the homes and businesses.
So near neighborhoods, just kind of, would they block any views of the Back Bay? You're nodding your head, yeah.
Yes, they would. We tried to, and we will continue to try to set those, in areas that, minimize that impact. But yes, they will impact the views, and it's going to be, big decision to make. The other alternatives that we use are non-structural alternatives, raising and floodproofing of those structures. So the three measures are very much highlighted in the report, although there are other things that we will look at, like natural and nature-based features, retreat from the floodplain altogether, you know, but the main structural solutions are the storm surge barriers and the flood walls, and then what we call non-structural is raising up of the homes and businesses.
So when you say the word retreat, Peter, are you talking about buying out homes, urging people in those communities, you know, especially as it becomes apparent in coming years that there's an increase in flooding and it might even be dangerous to live there, in moving people back?
Yeah, so the Corps is a great partner in this, providing this feasibility study to us, and that's the beginning for us. The state has to take this study and determine, when it's complete, what is best for the state. What direction do we want to go in? Do we want to participate in the construction of hard projects, hard civil works projects like flood walls and levees, or do we want to head towards buyouts, home elevations? But there's nothing cost-free here. It's everything has a cost, and the least expensive alternatives, such as home elevations, comes with an additional cost, because then you have to raise or elevate infrastructure and roads. So it gets complicated beyond the report at this point. But in the next couple of years, the report will be refined and give us more details to give us a little bit more idea of what is possible for the state when it decides what to choose.
Well, David Rosenblatt, I guess the question is, and I know it's early days, but which cost would be higher? What is your sense, David, and then you, Peter, of just saying, okay, you know, erecting all these, raising homes, you know, raising roads, putting up storm barriers, you know, et cetera, as opposed to just letting it be and letting communities figure it out and suffering the damages from increased flooding?
I don't think we can let the communities let it be. There will be parts of communities that will be more difficult to protect than others. But, you know, it's a little early to say at this point what we're going to be able to afford and not afford. It's very early in this game. So all alternatives are there for us to evaluate. And certainly we're not ruling anything out at this point. But if you look at the costs of the hard structures, the surge gates, the flood gates, it's daunting.
Yeah. What about the concept of the living shoreline? We did some stories on that down, I think it was around the Delaware Bay, I'll let you explain it. The living shoreline, what exactly is that? Peter Blum.
Sure. That's a more natural way of, I guess, flood risk management. So we'd be using environmental components to alleviate the flooding. So creation of wetlands, things like that, natural buffers.
So when you have flood situations, these natural wetlands do what?
The wetlands can absorb some flood water, but it's... they're not going to be as effective in protecting communities as civil works projects, for the most part. There'll be a valuable component, and there is value to preserving and enhancing wetlands on their own. They're part of a whole ecological system that could be lost as sea level rises. And we want to you know, get in there and figure out how best to preserve some of our wetlands too. But they're just the start of an active flood control program.
Are you? Oh, go ahead, Peter.
I was going to say they might work best when in conjunction with some of the other solutions. So all of these different alternatives that we're looking at are looked at separate and also in combination with each other.
What are you hearing, if anything, from communities along the Back Bay areas at this time?
They've been waiting a while for this report to reach this interim stage.
So what do they want to see? Have they specifically said, we want to see storm surge barriers, tide gates, or no, it's, you know, visually it's going to destroy the way, you know, we built here. It's beautiful. The sunrises are gorgeous. We're not going to be able to see what we want to see.
I think everybody's just digesting this report at this point. Mm-hmm. But when we've gone to the public with various projects, because the Army Corps has a very open process and a lot of public involvement. And certainly when smaller projects have been proposed for an area, they're concerned about the community looking different than it does, particularly if you elevate an historic area. They want to make sure that the visual sight lines to the water, to the wetlands, is not interrupted. So, you know, flood walls become problematic. They basically want the character of their area preserved as best as possible. And some alternatives will find that difficult to provide.
Is this getting, is there chatter on the federal level in Congress in terms of starting to look at this issue down the road? You're nodding your head, Peter. I mean.
Yes. You know, we've been having a very, very good response from our headquarters people and members of Congress. We've gotten funded. So, you know, there seems to be a very high priority with this.
Yeah. Well, the final report comes out in what, 3 years?
Yes, 2 to 3 years. By this year, next time, we'd like to select a tentative plan. So this process now that, you know, we released this interim report is going to be used to form, you know, the path forward, and we'll get everyone's input and see kind of how to shape the remainder of the study. So by this year, next time, we'll have a tentatively selected plan. And then we'll develop that plan further into the final report, which ultimately goes to Congress for authorization of a project.
So what is your sense of major components that might end up in this plan? If you had to bet on some, you know, answers as, you know, the storm surge barriers or tidal gates or you know, say $100 million poured into living shoreline development.
I think you'll see more home elevations.
Okay. That would be the first step.
Yeah, I think that is. I mean, you're if you drive down the shore, you'll see home elevations occurring everywhere. Some of that with FEMA money, some of that with private money when homes are under new construction. And so I think that'll continue to be a big part of this overall coastal resilience plan that, if I can put a little plug in here, the department is working towards a coastal resilience plan for the state of New Jersey. And this report will be certainly considered as part of what the alternatives are available to us.
How, just on a personal note, what are your feelings about, your observations about the effect so far of climate change on the shore? How has it changed life for coastal communities? We've got about, I guess, 30 seconds. So first, David?
I think that people are becoming more cognizant of the fact that there will be sea level rise. And I think it's in their mind when they make financial decisions about where they're going to live in the future, what they're going to buy. And for us, we're constantly thinking about what alternatives to use in the future and how can we afford those. So.
And Peter, thoughts?
Agree. I think we have a lot of tough decisions to make, and climate change is going to add to the amount of discussion that we have, sure.
Well, we'll watch for the report, the final report. Thanks so much for joining us. Peter Blum is Chief of Planning at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Philadelphia District. And David Rosenblatt, great to have you along as well. David is Assistant Commissioner for Engineering and Construction at the New Jersey DEP.
Thank you.
That's it for today's Radio Times Regional Roundup. Don't forget to visit us on social media and check out our podcasts as well at whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for being with us.